Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered 50 years ago yesterday, April 4th, 1968. He was responding to a plea for help by striking garbage and sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee. Now regarded as prophetic of his death the next day, Dr. King made a speech on the night of April 3rd at the Mason Temple in Memphis. "I have been to the mountaintop and I have seen the promised land," he said. A year earlier, Dr. King delivered a speech he titled "Beyond Vietnam" at Riverside Church in New York City on April 4th, 1967, 4 years after his "I Have a Dream" speech in Washington, D.C. "Beyond Vietnam" was his first major statement on the war. It became a focal point of the growing awareness of the link between militarism abroad and human rights at home, and a catalyst for further coordination between the civil rights and anti-war movements. Dr. King was assassinated exactly 1 year after his Riverside Church appearance. The following is a condensed version of that speech, which speaks quite eloquently to America's resurgent war fever half a century on. "Beyond Vietnam" by Martin Luther King Jr. "I come to this magnificent house of worship tonight because my conscience leaves me no other choice. A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relation to Vietnam. Over the past 2 years, as I have moved to break the betrayal of my own silences and to speak from the burnings of my own heart, as I have called for radical departures from the destruction of Vietnam, many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. At the heart of their concerns, this query has often loomed large and loud. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? And when I hear them, though I often understand the sources of their concern, I am nevertheless greatly saddened, for such questions mean that the inquirers have not really known me, my commitment, or my calling. Indeed, their questions mean that they do not know the world in which they live. In the light of such tragic misunderstanding, I deem it of signal importance to try to state clearly, and I trust concisely, why I believe that the path from Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, the church in Montgomery, Alabama, where I began my pastorate, leads clearly to this sanctuary tonight. Since I am a preacher by trade, I suppose it is not surprising that I have several reasons for bringing Vietnam into the field of my moral vision. There is at the outset a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seems as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. There were experiments, hopes, new beginnings. Then came the buildup in Vietnam, and I watched the program broken and eviscerated as if it were some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor, so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw people and skills and money like some demonical destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and attack it as such. Perhaps the more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers to die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Harlem. So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on television screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools. So we watched them in brutal solitude burning the huts of a poor village, but we realized that they would never live on the same block in Detroit. I could not be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor. My third reason moves to an even deeper level awareness, for it grows out of my experience in the ghettos of the North of the last 3 years, especially the last 3 summers. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles will not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they asked, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They asked if our nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, and for the sake of hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent. As I ponder the madness of Vietnam and search within myself for ways to understand and respond in compassion, my mind goes constantly to the people of that peninsula. I speak now not of the soldiers of each side, not the junta in Saigon, but simply of the people who have been living under the curse of war for almost three continuous decades now. I think of them, too, because it is clear to me that there will be no meaningful solution there until some attempt is made to know them and hear their broken cries. They must see Americans as strange liberators. The Vietnamese people proclaimed their own independence in 1945 after a combined French and Japanese occupation and before the Communist Revolution in China. They were led by Ho Chi Minh. Even though they quoted the American Declaration of Independence in their own document of freedom, we refused to recognize them. Instead, we decided to support France in its reconquest of its former colony. Our government felt then that the Vietnamese people were not ready for independence, and we again fell victim to the deadly Western arrogance that has poisoned the international atmosphere for so long. With that tragic decision, we rejected a revolutionary government seeking self-determination, and a government that had been established not by China, for whom the Vietnamese have no great love, but by clearly indigenous forces that included some communists. For the peasants, this new government meant real land reform, one of the most important needs in their lives. For 9 years following 1945, we denied the people of Vietnam the right of independence. For 9 years, we rigorously supported the French in their abortive attempt to recolonize Vietnam. Before the end of the war, we were meeting 80% of the French war costs. We encouraged them with our huge financial and military supplies to continue the war even after they had lost their will. Soon we would be paying almost the full cost of this tragic attempt at recolonization. After the French were defeated, it looked as if independence and land reform would come again through the Geneva Agreements. But instead there came the United States, determined that Ho Chi Minh should not unify the temporarily divided nation, and the peasants watched again as we supported one of the most vicious modern dictators, our chosen man, Premier Ngo Dinh Diem. After 1954, they watched us conspire with Diem to prevent elections which would surely have brought Ho Chi Minh to power over a united Vietnam, and they realized that they had been betrayed again. The peasants watched and cringed as Diem ruthlessly routed out all opposition, supported their extortionist landlords, and refused to even discuss reunification with the North. The peasants watched as all this was presided over by U.S. influence and then by increasing numbers of American troops who came to help quell the insurgency that Diem's methods aroused. When Diem was overthrown, they may have been happy, but the long line of military dictatorships seemed to offer no real change, especially in terms of their need for land and peace. The only change came from America as we increased our troop commitments in support of Saigon governments that were singularly corrupt, inept, and without popular support. All the while, the people read our leaflets and received our regular promises of peace and democracy and land reform. Now they languish under our bombs and consider us, not their fellow Vietnamese, the real enemy. We have destroyed their two most cherished institutions, the family and the village. We have destroyed their land and their crops. We have cooperated in crushing the nation's only non-communist revolutionary political force, the Unified Buddhist Church. We have supported the enemies of the peasants of Saigon. We have corrupted their women and children and killed their men. What liberators! Perhaps the more difficult but no less necessary task is to speak for those who have been designated as our enemies. What of the National Liberation Front, that strangely anonymous group we call Viet Cong or Communists? What must they think of us in America when they realize that we permitted the repression and cruelty of Diem, which helped bring them into being as a resistance group in the South? They are surely right to wonder what kind of new government we plan to help form without them, the only party in real touch with the peasants. They question our political goals, and they deny the reality of a peace settlement from which they will be excluded. Their questions are frighteningly relevant. Is our nation planning to build on political myth and then shore it up with the power of new violence? Hanoi remembers how our leaders refused to tell us the truth about the earlier North Vietnamese overtures toward peace, how we claimed that none existed when they had clearly been made. Ho Chi Minh has watched as America has spoken of peace and built up its forces. Perhaps only his sense of humor and irony can save him when he hears the most powerful nation of the world speaking of his aggression as it drops thousands of bombs on a poor, weak nation 8,000 miles away from its shores. At this point, I should make it clear that while I have tried in these last few minutes to give a voice to the voiceless of Vietnam and to understand the arguments of those who are called enemy, I am deeply concerned about our own troops there as anything else. For it occurs to me that what we are submitting them to in Vietnam is not simply the brutalizing process that goes on in any war where armies face each other and seek to destroy. We are adding cynicism to the process of death, for they must know after a short period there that none of the things we claim to be fighting for are really involved. Before long, they must know that their government has sent them into a struggle among Vietnamese, and the more sophisticated surely realize that we are on the side of the wealthy and secure while we create a hell for the poor. Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as a child of God and a brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak for the poor in America who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home and death and corruption in Vietnam. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as an American to the leaders of my own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must, therefore, be ours. We in the churches and synagogues have a continuing task while we urge our government to disengage itself from a disgraceful commitment. We must continue to raise our voices if our nation persists in its pervasive ways in Vietnam. We must be prepared to match action with words by seeking out every creative means of nonviolent protest possible. There are times for real choice and not false ones. We are at the moment when our lives must be placed on the line if our nation is to survive its own folly. Every person of humane convictions must decide on which form of political protest, but we must all protest. There is something seductively tempting about stopping there and sending us all off on what in some circles has become a popular crusade against the war in Vietnam. I say we must enter that struggle, but I wish to go on now and say something even more disturbing. The war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the American spirit, and if we ignore this sobering reality, we will find ourselves organizing the Clergy and Laymen Concerned Committee for the next generation. They will be concerned about Guatemala and Peru. They will be concerned about Thailand and Cambodia. They will be concerned about Mozambique and South Africa. We will be marching for these and a dozen other names and attending rallies without end unless there is a significant and profound change in American life and policy. I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. With righteous indignation, it will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries and say, "This is not just." It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of Latin America and say, "This is not just." the Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. These are revolutionary times. All over the globe, people are revolting against old systems of exploitation and oppression. And out of the wombs of a frail world, new systems of justice and equality are being born. The shirtless and barefoot peoples of the land are rising up as never before. The people who sat in the darkness have seen a great light. We in the West must support these revolutions. It is sad fact because of comfort, complacency, a morbid fear of communism, and our proneness to adjust to injustice. The Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. Now, let us begin. Let us rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter, but beautiful, struggle for a new world. This is the calling of the children of God, and our brothers and sisters wait eagerly for our response. Shall we say the odds are too great? Shall we tell them the struggle is too hard? Will our message be that the forces of American life militate against their arrival, and we send our regrets? Or will it be another message of longing, of hope, of solidarity with their yearnings, of commitment to their cause, whatever the cost? The choice is ours, and though we might prefer it to be otherwise, we must choose in this crucial moment of human history. And that was Martin Luther King, 1 year to the day before he was assassinated. And today, April 5th, is the day Allen Ginsberg died at age 70 in 1997. I would like next to read part two of the poem Howl, which made him famous and remains his most famous poem. It was from Howl, written in 1954, that the world first paid attention to one of its greatest poets. From Howl, part two, by Allen Ginsberg. What sphinx of cement and aluminum bashed open their skulls and ate up their brains in imagination? Moloch, solitude, filth, ugliness, ash cans, and unobtainable dollars. Children screaming under the stairways, boys sobbing in armies, old men weeping in parks. Moloch, Moloch, nightmare of Moloch, Moloch the loveless, mental Moloch, Moloch the heavy judger of men. Moloch, the incomprehensible prison. Moloch, the crossbones, soulless jailhouse and congress of sorrows. Moloch, whose buildings are judgment. Moloch, the vast stone of war. Moloch, the stunned governments. Moloch, whose mind is pure machinery. Moloch, whose blood is running money. Moloch, whose fingers are 10 armies. Moloch, whose breast is a cannibal dynamo. Moloch, whose ear is a smoking tomb. Moloch, whose eyes are 1,000 blind windows. Moloch, whose skyscrapers stand in the long streets like endless Jehovah's. Moloch, whose factories dream and croak in the fog. Moloch, whose smokestacks and antennae crown the cities. Moloch, whose love is endless oil and stone. Moloch, whose soul is electricity and banks. Moloch, whose poverty is the specter of genius. Moloch, whose fate is a cloud of sexless hydrogen. Moloch, whose name is the mind. Moloch, in whom I sit lonely. Moloch, in whom I dream angels. Crazy in Moloch. Lack love and manless in Moloch. Moloch, who entered my soul early. Moloch, in whom I am a consciousness without a body. Moloch, who frightened me out of my natural ecstasy. Moloch, whom I abandon. Wake up in Moloch. Light streaming out of the sky. Moloch. Moloch, robot apartments, invisible suburbs, skeleton treasures, blind capitals, demonic industries, spectral nations, invincible madhouses, granite penises, monstrous bombs. They broke their backs lifting Moloch to heaven, pavements, trees, radios, tons, lifting the city to heaven, which exists and is everywhere about us. Visions, omens, hallucinations, miracles, ecstasies, gone down the American River. Dreams, adorations, illuminations, religions, the whole boatload of sensitive BS. Breakthroughs, over the river, flips and crucifixions, gone down the flood. Highs, epiphanies, despairs, then years, animal screams and suicides, minds, new loves, mad generation, down on the rocks of time, real holy laughter in the river. They saw it all, the wild eyes, the holy yells. They bade farewell. They jumped off the roof to solitude, waving, carrying flowers, down to the river, into the street. And that was part two of Howl by Allen Ginsberg, who died today at the age of 70 in 1997. And as epilogue and epitaph, something I wrote, a lesser death occurred last Thursday, which I have recently learned was the second annual Vietnam Veterans Day, which I had not heard of. My sister's dog, Jake, died that day after a long struggle with blindness, deafness, and diabetes. This death was not in combat, but certainly was replete with courage and fortitude. Jake was a quiet, steady, observant dog, even sagacious in his even-tempered attitude toward persons, places, other animals, and nearly everything else. He was a small, black, curly-haired dog of a breed my sister knows about, but I don't. I think if you were to measure Jake's age by the often disputed 1-to-7 ratio, its antiquity belies its accuracy. He was in his early 90s. He was a birthday puppy for my sister Mary from her partner Fran, who died of ALS in late 2010. Jake got old and contracted diabetes, which induced the blindness and deafness. My sister went through every stage of his life with him. At the end, her home was Jake's sanctuary and medical clinic, which included twice daily insulin shots. She was, in full sense, Mother Mary. The last few months, he steadily lost his sense of direction, but even then, Jake patiently bumped his way to my sister's chair and bedroom. He never complained, not a whimper. He did have a few panic attacks, generally when my sister took him to the vet in Newport, which became often. Afterward, on the rides back to Waldport, he seemed as relaxed as melted butter, perhaps because he was as fussed over at the vet's as a newborn baby. Last Thursday, Jake's heart and lungs were convulsed with rapid, painful breathing, which defied emergency medicine prescribed by the vet. My sister said it was time to end Jake's suffering. She called the vet, who said he would administer the final solution at home. That morning, a friend phoned from the Midwest and reminded me that that same Thursday was the anniversary of our arrival in Vietnam 52 years ago as U.S. Marines aboard a vintage World War II Navy troop ship. So when the veterinarian came to end Jake's life, I was consciously infused with memories of dead friends from half a century ago. After our lachrymose goodbyes and two deadly shots, Jake was cradled in my sister's arms and stared at me with his blind eyes as he went still. The vet, a very capable, empathetic man, said Jake had lived much longer than anyone thought and praised his courage and strength of will. When the vet wrapped Jake in a large cloth to prepare him for cremation, I instantly flashed on the many dead and wounded friends we survivors wrapped in ponchos and tossed into helicopters and never saw or heard about again. I felt that way about Jake, whose ashes would at least remain in a green crystal vase my sister had set aside for him. There is one for Fran on a shelf and another awaiting my sister. That night, I talked to the man in the moon, his sardonic vaudevillian face looking down from an oval glare. I wondered how many millions of human beings were mourning beloved dogs in that moment, and dogs howling at the moon for beloved humans. The next day, I learned that Jake had died on the second annual Vietnam Veterans Day, which I suppose is a sleight of hand to beat the war victory drums, which we Vietnam veterans tarnished by losing our war. We have been blamed by the war's inventors ever since. The idea of a special day that might be to wrap us losers in the flag so that a few Vietnam draft dodgers like our whacked out president and his 4F chicken hawk warmongers can have their parade in war without Vietnam vets causing any embarrassments. I suppose I might consider it ironic that the date of my first day at war has become the iconic symbol of American withdrawal from the war 7 years later, the day the first soldiers of that great escaping armada left Vietnam to its fate on the same date of March 29th in 1973. This is Michael McCusker.